On this edition, my guest is Dr. Jalajay Bonheim. We're going to be talking about her book, The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Welcome to the program. Why have we failed to create the happy, peaceful world that we all want? And what can we do about it? Well, for more than three decades, Jalajay Bonheim has explored these questions in her work with women, leaders, activists, spiritual seekers from all over the world. Well, in her new book, The Sacred Ego, she tackles one of the core myths of popular spiritual culture, the myth of the ego, supposedly responsible for our greed, selfishness, and even violence. In contrast, Bonheim approaches the ego as a sacred function worthy of honor and gratitude. With amazing stories from her work, she guides us into the depths of our collective psyche to pinpoint the real sources of our problems and illuminate our path to wholeness. Well, founder and director of the Institute for Circle Work, Jalajay Bonheim, Ph.D., is one of the world's foremost experts in the use of circle gatherings as a tool for empowering women. A uniquely skilled facilitator, Bonheim has trained hundreds of female circle leaders from around the world and is internationally known for her groundbreaking work with Israeli and Palestinian women in the Middle East. Growing up German and Jewish in post-war Germany, Bonheim struggled to make sense of the events that had left both the German and Jewish people deeply traumatized. This struggle guided her work and led her to new views. It's a joy that she's taken the time to be with us, and she's joining us from Ithaca, New York. Jalajay, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard. I'm delighted to be here.
I enjoyed this book. And by the way, I was pleased to see that your publisher was North Atlantic Books. They really have this great series going on in terms of sacred activism, don't they?
They really do. They have some wonderful authors, Andrew Harvey and Charles Eisenstein, fabulous people.
I want to start off, which I don't always do, but with the introduction of the book. First of all, one of my favorite people, I loved the term he coined, reverence for life, and that was a great Albert Schweitzer. You had a wonderful quote from him, and it goes, "In the hearts of people today, there is a deep longing for peace. When the true spirit of peace is thoroughly dominant, it becomes an inner experience with unlimited possibilities. Only when this really happens, when the spirit of peace awakens and takes possession of men's hearts, can humanity be saved from perishing." I love that quote. You start off with, I would say, your story that kind of sets up this book. Can you share a little bit of that with our listeners, and also why you chose that Schweitzer quote to begin your book?
Well, let's start with the second question, why I chose that quote.
Yeah.
In our culture, there is a belief that the heart is nice, it's good for Valentine's Day cards, but it's not really practical. People who tell you to live from the heart, they're idealists. It's not really a practical way to live your life. And, you know, as someone who works in the Middle East with these very difficult conflicts, and I've worked with so many different groups in conflict, one of the things I have learned is that when people are in conflict, it is only from the heart that the resolution will come. And that as long as they stay locked in their rational mind, you'll go round and round in circles and get nowhere.
Mm.
So I love this Schweitzer quote because he really conveys the incredible power of what I call heart thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that far from impractical, it is actually the most practical solution that we have.
Yeah. You know, Schweitzer, I believe he passed away in the 50s, but towards the end of his life, he was involved in a lot of causes. But he also had hopes that a great new renaissance would unfold. that there literally would be this epic paradigm shift going on in the way people are loving and living on this planet. As you travel around the world and with the body of work that you've already been doing, what is your take on how humanity is receiving this desire to operate more from the heart and to help create a more peaceful humanity in this world?
You know, the way I see it is almost like there are these two different realities or two levels of reality that are happening simultaneously. So when you look at our mainstream society or you read the news, things look very discouraging. You know, it seems like our world is more violent than ever, more greedy than ever, and so on. And yet, as I go around and I work with people, I realize there is another reality, and that is that millions of people everywhere are making this shift towards heart thinking and towards realigning themselves with nature, realigning themselves with the planet. And I see it happening everywhere I go. I really do think it is a global shift that is occurring. And it's not very visible in the news. And yet, from what I see in working with people, it's very real and it's very powerful.
Yeah. Andrew Harvey, who's been a friend of this radio show, and I actually brought him here to Indianapolis several years ago, he would often say, "What wakes you up at 3 a.m? You know, what's the, and I'm wondering for you, again, with the work that you do and what this book is about, what wakes you up at 3 a.m? What's on your heart most of all right now, these days?
Well, I think that we are living in a time of such profound change that it is very easy to go into fear. And you know, when you talk about waking up at 3 a.m, I think a lot of people wake up at 3 a.m. with these tremendous fears. Are my children going to survive? Are they going to have a viable future? And what happens to me when those fears rise up is that I hear them as a call to turn my consciousness towards love, towards the source, towards spirituality, towards that deeper truth that lies within us all. So, you know, fear can push us in both directions. It can cause us to contract and to hold on to the old ways that we think are safe and secure, even as they are crumbling all around us. Mm-hmm. But fear can also really shake us awake.
Yes.
And I think that that is what it is meant to do today.
Mm-hmm. You're German and you're also Jewish. How do you think growing up as a Jew in post-war Germany affected you?
It affected me very profoundly. Really, I don't think I would be doing the work that I'm doing today if it were not for that. My father was one of the few German Jews who, after the war, chose to return to Germany. And so, even as a very young child, I would look at, you know, because the town we lived in, Cologne, had really been completely bombed to the ground. And so, you know, in the 50s and 60s, the cities were still being rebuilt, and there was still a lot of devastation, both physically and, of course, even more so psychologically. And at the same time, being Jewish, I was acutely aware of the concentration camps and what had happened in this country. So one of the things it led me to was that clearly, one could not blame a particular group. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about being German. It wasn't about being Jewish. Mm-hmm. Because I saw that similar things were happening all around the planet, where groups of people were getting into these atrocities against each other. Now, as a child, I really had no way of making sense of this, and I think I just sort of concluded that humans were messed up. that there was just something very wrong with our species. And even today, I meet a lot of people who say that. They say, you know, human beings are just a mess. And I think, had I not gotten into the work I do with healing groups of people, working with a collective consciousness, I might still feel the same way. But the work that I do has allowed me to see very deeply into the human psyche and really see the incredible wisdom and courage and beauty that lies within people. And it is our responsibility to create environments where that beauty can really emerge, because we all long for that.
We're bringing love to life here on WICR with my special guest, Dr. Jalaja Bonheim. We're talking about her newest book, The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. We'll have much more of this conversation, but first, a short break. Welcome back to the program. It's a joy to have Jalaja Bonheim on today. We're talking about her book, The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. You just briefly alluded to this in the first segment, but your work, you worked with Jewish and Palestinian women in the Middle East. Can you tell us more about that experience?
Yes, this is actually something I do on a regular basis. In April, I'll be returning. And when I first was invited to work there, I wondered whether the kind of circle gatherings that I was leading here in the United States would actually be effective there. Mm-hmm. And especially bringing together these different populations, Jews, Palestinians, but also Bedouins, Druze. And what I found was that even more than here, people have this tremendous longing for a different way of relating. And in Israel, actually, Jews and Arabs are very segregated. It's a little bit like it was here 100 years ago with black people and white people. Mm-hmm. And so for many of them, my circles are the first place, for some of them, the only place where they really connect as human beings. And because I work with the women, you know, most of them are mothers. And I think that's relevant because they want a better future for their children. And they understand that violence is not the answer. Which doesn't mean that the process is easy. It is not easy. You know, the conflict is very real. The amount of trauma is just horrendous. And personally, I believe that we need to heal that trauma. Otherwise, it will keep replicating itself. Mm. And that's one of the reasons I'm so committed to this work in the Middle East, because I feel that, you know, the political negotiations, all of that is well and good. Mm-hmm. But what it comes down to is human relationships. And what the women are learning in the circle is a new way of relating. And it is a way that they experience as leading to healing and leading to harmony. So they really get it. And more I am training them to lead their own circles. So they are now holding their own circles, both in the West Bank for Palestinian women, mm-hmm. and then throughout Israel.
Mm. What's the age range of the women that you work with?
All ages, really. Mm-hmm. In the United States, the women tend to be, I'd say, 40s and 50s, because they tend to be people who already have done a lot of inner work.
Right.
But really all ages, and it's one of the beautiful things that you get these old grandmothers and these young women together.
Yeah.
For everyone.
You've mentioned these circles. You've been training women to lead circle gatherings for years now. What is a circle gathering? And let's go a little deeper into why they're so important and transformative.
Yes. I mean, circle gatherings can be used for many different purposes. I mean, you think, for example, of AA meetings. They are circle gatherings. Or Boy Scouts, you know, there's many ways to use circle gatherings. And people have always understood that the circle is a great tool for creating a sense of connectedness among people. But the way that I am using circle gatherings, first of all, it has a spiritual orientation. It really has a ceremonial aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
And my purpose is really to awaken people to their oneness. And so the process that unfolds in the circle, it begins really with bringing people into their hearts, bringing them out of their mind into their heart. And we're using silence, we're using movement, music, poetry, touch, you know, many different elements. And so what unfolds is this amazing, really sacred process where, as the facilitator, I'm not forcing it in any direction. I am just holding the container for the healing and the wisdom that is there to unfold.
Mm.
And it's a very spacious experience. You know, I feel that our world is way too busy and hectic and full. And because of that, of course, our own mind is too busy and hectic and full. And so part of what happens in the circles is that we slow down and that there really is a sense of being able to rest and to come home to oneself, to really listen deeply
mm-hmm.
to each other and also to ourselves.
You mentioned how our mind is often too busy and full. And in a chapter that you talk about thought addiction as a major obstacle to inner peace,
mm-hmm.
you also have another great quote from one of my heroes, and that's Thomas Merton. In just the first line or two in that quote, he says, "The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence."
Yeah.
And yet we see so much of that, I do at least, increasing in the world today, especially in Western society. For our listeners, what is thought addiction?
Well, you know, we think of thought as this wonderful tool, which it is, something that, you know, humans are blessed with. But we have reached a point where our ability to think is not optional. You know, it's we can't stop our mind. It's obsessive. It's compulsive. And so at this point, it has really become an addiction, where people say to me, "I so long for inner peace, and I cannot shut off my mind."
Mm.
You know, and we've become such consumers of painkillers and sleeping pills and on, all because of thought addiction. And unfortunately, our society doesn't view it as an addiction. You know, you get rewarded for it. And children in school are being trained to be thought addicts. And there is this mistaken belief, which I alluded to previously, that somehow our mind is capable of solving all the problems, so that if only we think faster and harder, we will get everything under control.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just the biggest illusion, the biggest lie that we have swallowed.
Yeah. Yeah, so someone like Rilke then says to us, whoever you are, as evening descends, let go of those familiar walls and enter the vastness beyond. And you know what? If we don't, that's where that thought addiction comes in. I've been so aware of that lately with some of the presidential candidates, and oftentimes the fear that is being tossed out there. And with 24-hour news cycles and with Twitter and Facebook and the beauty of technology, but also the curse of technology. And if we're not careful, if we're not disciplined enough, Jalaja, we get caught up in that.
We all get caught up in it. I mean, I certainly include myself. I had to, just last week, I sort of had to put this moratorium on Facebook for myself because I could see I was just getting caught up in it. You know, it's so compelling, so seductive. But then you look back and you think, what have I done with this hour? Mm-hmm. You know, where is the real juice, the real nourishment?
Yeah.
It doesn't come from that.
Right.
And I also think that we, you know, another great fallacy is that we should be able to make all these changes by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We should be able to do it all by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I love the circle so much is because it becomes so clear that we are together on this collective journey. And the changes that need to be made are not changes that we can make in isolation. You know, we need the support because we are going against the flow. Everything in our society is telling us, be busy, do more, think more. And so we need a community that really supports us in living differently, living in a way that really pleases our own soul.
Yeah. How profound was Gandhi with that classic quote, be the change you want to see in the world?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
On today's program, we're making peace with ourselves and our world with the help of Jalaja Bonheim. She's visionary teacher, author of a great new book, The Sacred Ego. We'll have more of this, but first, a short break. Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life today with Jalaja Bonheim. We're talking about her book, The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. And in your book, you say that to live in peace, we need a kind of education that we aren't getting. And you call it relational education. I love that phrase. What is relational education and how can it bring peace?
You know, when you think about what is the one skill that every one of us is going to need in life, regardless of what we do. It's the ability to create and maintain fulfilling relationships. It is absolutely foundational to our happiness and well-being. And yet, we are not teaching this to our children. It is unbelievable to me, especially when you look around the world and you see how many of our problems have to do with our failure to relate well.
Mm.
And, you know, we wonder, why do kids come to school with guns?
Mm-hmm.
Even lions and elephants teach their young ones how to be good members of the community. And all indigenous peoples provided that kind of education. I think it's absolutely essential that we bring that into every level, from kindergarten to university. You know, here I live in Ithaca, New York, which is the home of Cornell University. And so many students tell me that they feel incredibly isolated and alone. There are no places where they can really share in an authentic and honest way with each other.
Hmm.
And there is no education on what to do when you are in conflict or what to do when your needs are not being met. All these things that are very teachable,
mm-hmm.
But they are rarely being taught.
I always find that fascinating. I remember years ago, my mom was a big fan of his. I became a fan of his long after he retired. I have every one of his books. Ended up doing a radio interview with him before he passed away, and I'm talking about Dr. Leo Buscaglia. And Leo, even back in that day when he was on PBS all the time, used to talk about, why aren't we teaching love in the schools?
Yes.
We teach everything else, math, science, geography. We don't teach about love, and that's what you're saying too. We don't teach the relational skills that really are the most important skills to learn. And
that
we still
so
don't.
So true, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so true. And also, you know, what you're highlighting is such an important point, which is that love is not just this wonderful emotion that we experience now and then. Love, you know, to really live in love requires a lot of skill. There is a lot of learning involved.
Yeah.
And absolutely, I think we should be teaching love. And that is really what I'm doing in my circle gatherings.
And one of the other skills that you address that I think also needs to be taught, and I learned a lot about this back in the day when I was a hospice chaplain, about the power of simply being present and listening. You call it deep listening. Can you share a little bit about how listening, simply listening, can help heal communities?
Yeah, you know, I often find in my circles that there are certain people who speak very readily and easily and have no trouble, and then there are always people who are shy and don't really have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the circle, because we are going round from one person to the other, and there is a structure that ensures that each person can speak as long as they want and no one will interrupt them, what begins to happen is that these people who did not have a voice begin to find their voice. They begin to find their power. They begin to realize they actually have something to say that is of value and that people want to hear them. So in terms of empowerment, that deep listening is very important. It's even more important when you are working with healing, you know, because the first step in healing is for the wound to be seen, to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very important in the Middle East, that we can provide a space where people can really share their pain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not sharing their pain so that it can be fixed. They're sharing it so that they can come out of isolation and feel connected and received and heard. It's absolutely essential. It's really miraculous sometimes what happens in that process?
Well, people deserve to be seen and deserve to be heard, don't they? And when they feel that from the other, you're right. Amazing transformations and healings can take place.
Yes, yes. There's a story that I love that I tell, you know, it's the story about this wonderful therapist who is a friend of mine, actually an African-American man. And in The Sacred Ego, I tell this story of how he worked with a white man who turned out to be an ardent racist and a Ku Klux Klan member. And because this man had been arrested on drug-related charges, he had no choice but to work with this African-American counselor, because it was either that or go to jail. And so in the process of their working together, all that my friend did was listen, validate him. He never reacted. He never judged his racism. He just listened. He was present with him. And over the course of a year, this man completely transformed to the point that at the end of the year, he profusely thanked his black counselor for really saving his life. And that really is the power of being present, listening, holding, containing, without judgment, without reactivity.
Yeah, I love that story. That was in a chapter titled The Racist Transformation. And when I was reading that and now hearing you tell it, it reminded me that if it happens to one person, it can happen to another, and then another, and then another. And I love that quote from the Buddha about in separateness lies the world's great misery. In compassion lies the world's true strength. And that's where we're at, I think, today. More than ever, we're needing to make a choice as a humanity. Which direction are we going to go?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the beautiful thing, I think, is, too, that, yes, this is what the world needs. You know, yes, this, if we want to save our planet, this is the direction we need to go in. But at the same time, this is also what our own soul wants. You know, so it's not just something that we are doing out of altruism or to save the planet. It's because our own soul is longing for a world where we really can connect in a way that is authentic and compassionate and real.
Mm. Yes, and that's what I would call bringing love to life. And we're doing that right now here on WICR for our listeners. My guest today is Dr. Jalaja Bonheim. She's visionary, teacher, author, travels around the world creating women's circles and doing so much good work out there. This book is called The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. We're going to continue this conversation, but first, a short break. Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life today with Jalaja Bonheim. We're talking about her book, The Sacred Ego. We've been mentioning the title, and by the way, I want to direct our listeners to the website, sacredego.com. So, what is a sacred ego, and how can it assist in conflict resolution?
Well, sacredness really is a quality of perception. You know, so when you're looking at, let's say, a sunset, or you're listening to a beautiful piece of music, it's not that the sunset is sacred or the music is sacred. It's that there is a state of consciousness in which you can perceive that sacredness.
Mm.
And so my book really is an invitation to people to perceive the intrinsic sacredness of our ego. The ego is essential, it is necessary, it is helpful, it is useful, it is also wounded. But the fact that something or someone is wounded does not deny their sacredness. Mm-hmm. You know, and as long as we relate to our ego as this bad thing that we would like to get rid of, we will never be able to transform it, because we cannot heal what we judge and reject. And so this rejection of the ego, that I see it in so many spiritual seekers that I work with, it leads to a kind of inner warfare.
Yeah.
You know, where you have labeled this very important part of your being as negative and undesirable. So what I try to do is help people understand, how did this ego evolve? How did it become what it is today? Where are the problems? Because without doubt, our ego is wounded. It is in need of healing. And how can we help it really serve the sacred purpose that it is meant to serve, which is the purpose of protecting our species?
In your book, you also explore a concept that I really enjoyed reading about. I'd like for you to share more about it, and that's the concept of heart thinking. What are some steps that we can take to practice it, and what can it help us achieve as individuals, but also as a species?
Well, you know, our body is such a great ally. Obviously, the heart is a part of the body. And one of the reasons I like to work a lot with movement and sound and so on is because as we connect more deeply with our bodies, we begin to feel our heart more. And it gets to the point that just by willing it, you can shift from your attention from your mind down to your heart. And that shift is one that you may need to make hundreds of times every day. But people consistently find that as they begin to move through their days more from that heart space, their lives become more peaceful, more fulfilling, their relationships transform. It is simply the way that we were intended to live. And what I call head thinking is very fragmenting. You know, it disconnects us from our body. It disconnects us from our heart. Now, one thing that's important to understand is when we are doing what I call heart thinking, we're still using the mind. It's not like we're not using our mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we are using our mind in service of the heart rather than using the mind to dominate and oppress the heart.
You tell a great story also in this book about encountering a guy who you had pegged, I believe, at first glance as a redneck, possibly even a bigot, and you attempt to see him with what you call sacred eyes. What do you mean by that, and what did that experience teach you, Jalaja?
Well, it was a great example of how, you know, I lead the circle, but also the circle teaches me.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I had given this workshop gathering of women that I was working with at the time and a homework assignment. And that homework assignment was, whenever you meet someone for the next few hours, I want you to inwardly really bow to that person, really honor them inwardly as a sacred being. And so here I am, I'm sitting at this cafe in the boonies somewhere, and there's this guy who is, I find him kind of obnoxious, and he's riddling with me with questions, and you know, my knee-jerk response really is just, build a wall around myself. I don't want to have anything to do with this guy. He's a redneck. You know, just keep him away. But I had given the women this piece of homework, so I really couldn't do that. And I started inwardly just talking to him and saying to him, you know, I really, excuse me, forgive me, I really don't know anything about you. I'm judging you in this way. And I want to really honor you as a sacred being. And so I was doing this inwardly. As I was talking to him, it turned out he was the owner of this restaurant. And he was peppering me with questions, what was I doing in this area, etc. And so I mentioned that I was leading a gathering, a retreat of about 15 women. And then the guy, you know, vanishes off into the kitchen, and I'm there in peace reading my book. And when the time to leave came, I'm about to, you know, walk out the door, and he comes rushing out of the kitchen, and he says, wait, wait. And I'm thinking, what now? What does he want now? And he goes back into the kitchen, and he comes out with these three steaming hot pies. And he explains to me that he baked these for the women in my circle. And it was just one of those moments that is so humbling and really made me so aware of the power of our own inner attitude.
Yes.
You know, that as we honor each other, we really do call forth the best in each other.
Yeah.
It was really a great learning experience for me.
Well, it's probably what Washington needs now more than ever. Our politicians
yes.
need to be seeing each other through sacred eyes.
Yeah. Yes.
You had another interesting chapter. It's a chapter called Control Addiction, and you begin by considering the global climate that has allowed 50 Shades of Grey to become so popular. What can be learned by examining the world's current fascination with masochism?
I asked myself a lot, what is it about that? Why is that so popular? And, you know, without judging it in any way, nothing wrong with it, but what is it? Why are people so drawn to this? And I realized that what this is about is really being forced to let go of control.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, we can't enjoy sexuality, we can't enjoy any kind of pleasure, really, if we can't relax, if we can't let go of control. And so the fact that we have become so addicted to control, and, you know, previously we were talking about thought addiction. Thought is, of course, our most powerful instrument of control. So if we want to have control, we use our mind. And so we have become really addicted to trying to control nature, trying to control the world, our environment, our relationships, everything. And that creates a major barrier when it comes to sexuality or when it comes to really just enjoying life. And so I think that this interest in sadism and masochism, is really an attempt to overcome that control addiction that is really getting in our way,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the point that people can't just open. And when you think about what is the essence of sexuality, it has so much to do with letting go. And as control addicts, that for many people has become really, really difficult.
Yeah. When I hear the word control, I also think of masculine energy. I think more and more people are getting hip and becoming more aware of the power of energy, that everything is energy, and there's a masculine energy and a feminine energy. And many would say that it was predominantly masculine energy that got this world into the shape it is and the wars that constantly are being created. And many are calling for more of the feminine to take hold, to unfold in this world. Later in the book, you talk about invoking the feminine to heal our world. So why is the feminine so important to all of these ideas that we're talking about? And how do you define feminine energy? And what is particularly vital about it in the pursuit of peace?
Yeah, this is such a tricky issue, you know, because I really don't agree, for example, with Jung, who...
Uh-huh.
speaks of the masculine and the feminine energy, and then he speaks of men having the inner feminine and women having the inner masculine. I think, again, that that fragments us. And that actually we each have this entire spectrum of possibilities within us, whether we are male or female. So when we associate, for example, control with the masculine, that comes out of our specific culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what we have been taught to associate with the masculine. I don't think that it is inherently masculine, nor do I think that qualities such as compassion or tenderness or receptivity are inherently feminine. But in our culture, we are taught to see them this way. And so women have far more permission to cultivate receptivity, gentleness, beauty, and so on. And these are the qualities that we need today. There's no question. And so I think this is one of the reasons why women have been, in many ways, leading the way. They have an easier time embodying vulnerability, for example, emotional vulnerability, emotional authenticity. These are not intrinsically female or feminine capacities at all. But in our culture, this is how it has evolved.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to emphasize that, because otherwise you're talking about, for example, a man who is tender or receptive. When you say, well, he has his inner feminine, you are subtly implying that that is not his real nature, you know. This is some other aspect.
Yeah, right.
Versus really seeing we each have that whole spectrum within us. And we each have our own assertiveness, our own power, our own tenderness. It's in every one of us.
Yeah. We've been bringing love to life today with Jalaja Bonheim, PhD, visionary, teacher, author. The book is The Sacred Ego, Making Peace with Ourselves and Our World. And how can people contact you and perhaps even get involved in your work?
Yes, the easiest way is for them to go to my website, sacredego.com. If people would like to know more about circle work and about the upcoming workshops in Israel and Palestine, they can also visit the website of the nonprofit organization that I lead, which is called the Institute for Circle Work. And so they can just go to instituteforcirclework.org to find out more about that.
Wonderful. I so appreciate you taking the time to be on today's show, and I want to thank you for the book that you've written, but also the work that you're doing around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's been my pleasure.
Once again, her website is sacredego.com. And in closing, we're going to play a short segment of an interview I did with iconic Jean Houston. This was taped several years ago. I still remember when I had the good fortune of meeting her at Notre Dame and actually had a chance to speak in front of her and her social artist group. She's going to be talking about her social artist training and just her take on the world. This is the great Jean Houston.
And what I have found is that all over the world, in my work with leadership, too many of the problems in society today stem in part from leadership that is ill-prepared to deal with a world as complex as ours. I mean, other times in history thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it. This is the most important time in human history. And people have been prepared to deal with the world, to be white males of the year 1926. And I find this in virtually every country that I've been in. Leaders living out of a field of awareness that is limited, that's limiting in their ability to deal with the world as it is today. And I find that worldwide, societies are asking for new kind of leaders, preparation of new kind of people who essentially It's as if their inner space, mm-hmm. their inner capacities are equal to the immense complexity of their outer world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to create programs that would begin to train leaders, and then suddenly I found myself joining up with the United Nations Development Program and becoming a senior consultant there to begin to create these kinds of programs. So I've been in, oh good Lord, in the last few very recent times, I've worked with the leadership of Albania, the Eastern Caribbean, the island states there, Kenya, with delegations from Tanzania, Uganda. I've just sent some of my teams to Nepal, and in a couple of months I'll be in both Australia and the Philippines. And this gives you an idea of what my life is like, because we find that you know, as I've also worked with two United States presidents and three first ladies, and some of their similar forms in other countries,
mm-hmm.
but we find at every level people are striving to have perspective, depth, a sense of purpose, a sense of there must be another history for this world at this time. I sometimes think of this world as God's school. You know,
yeah.
Here we are, you know, a planet in a little sun at the outer wing of a galaxy, and not in the center where all, you know, the stars are close up. And it's as if this, it's like the Skunk Works, where we're at the outer edge. This is the experimental lab, where we're allowed to run through every foolishness and glory the imaginable in order to really learn what it is to be a God seed, to be one who has the capacity to create new forms, perhaps planets, perhaps beings, perhaps more likely social structures. And so I think that this is the critical time when we're moving from where we were to where we can be. I've spent a lifetime studying the human potential, and we discover that most people, given opportunity, given training, can learn to think and be and use so much more of themselves in ways that hitherto would have seemed more mythic than real. We're in mythic times. We are missing links. So in this work of seeing how people can learn to think in multiple ways, we tap into the tremendous resources of their own creativity that lie just beneath the surface crust of consciousness, tap into the great stories and mythic journeys that each one of us contains, tap into the matrix of becoming, which is the spiritual yearning. If you learn to do this, and we really offer state-of-the-art strategies to do these things, and then apply it to social problems, oh, what a difference it makes, and what a difference it's making now as we're working all over the world.
You write in The Possible Human that nothing is more urgent today than our need to overcome archaic constraints of tribalism, nationalism, and ecological mayhem.
That's right.
Speak to that as far as
do. This is the great either-or of history.
Mm-hmm.
Either we really do it in the next few generations, or we can forget about it. I've been traveling over the earth for a very long time, and I remember some decades ago, I would fly over Africa and look like Africa. You fly over Africa now, and the sub-Sahara desert has expanded in all directions. You fly over North Dakota, and you see the clay, you know, just coming up out of the earth. You see the ravaging of the forest, the loss of one species every 25 minutes. Every 25 minutes, another species is lost. We are earth beings. And when we forget our continuity with the earth, then we have lost not only the earth, we've lost our own souls. I mean, the level of problems is so great that it is as if we are being challenged to the very roots of our humanity in ways we never have before. So what I'm trying to do, Richard, is create a whole new profession. In fact, I've done so. And I've got, as I say, I have my troops deployed all over the world now. not troops, quite the opposite. A harmonious, compassionate, creative people. But also to try to help people become all that they can be. Because, as you know, to begin to live out, what is it T.S. Eliot said, redeem the time, redeem the unread vision of the higher dream. The unread vision, the codes, the capacities that we all contain within us, so that we can begin to become adequate stewards of this, the most critical time in human history.
Yeah.
You know, I've never met a stupid child. I've met incredibly stupid systems of education that demean and diminish. You put art back as central to the curriculum, where a child is learning spelling or history by incarnating it, by dramatizing it, learning fractions by weaving. I mean, you begin to bring the arts as a weave into the curriculum. Children don't fail. We helped create 50,000 new schools in Bangladesh based on putting the art and the culture back in the curriculum. I mean, there's just so many things that can be done. Well, the state of the art is very high. State of application is not. I am trying to extend both the art and the application all over the world.
It speaks about awareness. It reminds me of something Hafiz once wrote. He said, "What is this precious love and laughter budding in our hearts? It's the glorious sound of a soul waking up." That's what I'm hearing you say. Souls need to wake up.
Well, it's wake-up time. You know, in the Gnostic Gospel of St. Thomas, Jesus, who's rather eccentric in that Gospel, he says, "I came into this world, and I found you were all drunk. I'm here to wake you up out of your drunkenness." And I think that especially, you know, in the last, 20, 30, 40 years, the drunkenness, the lostness, the sleepiness of materialism. And whenever you have that level of materialism, you lose a sense of imagination. You lose a sense of the passion for the possible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so many people feel the hound of heaven going, "Roof, roof, 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 roof," you know, at the heels of the morning. Wake up, get on with it, get on with it. And so this is what we're trying to do. I'm trying to help people expand their vision, their courage, so they can serve their families, their communities. I'm helping them to try to awaken up, not just to the many different capacities they have, but the many cultures in their own life. I'm trying to help them wake up to forgotten capabilities, to remember and learn new forms for society, to become an authentic agent of change, and to become a leader in this chaotic and complex time.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with the term social artistry?
I have no idea. It may have, you know, Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, lived with us the last 6 years of her life. And we used to have a lot of talks about these kinds of things. You know, she would say, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And so she began to bring me into these small groups.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the groups was the Tarrytown group. And it was Margaret and Bob Schwartz and myself. And then we would invite it was generally once a month, sometimes it was twice a month, and this went on for about 3-4 years. And every month we would invite somebody to help us, you know, a major thinker like Jeff Schumacher, you know, and we would deal with world problems. And she would get me up to task. She said, "Jean, I need a 30-page paper on stress by the end of this week." "Yes, ma'am." And I'd go and I'd somehow, you know, she made these demands, so you had to respond. And so we would work on world problems. And then she would call up whoever was the president of the United States at the time at the end of the weekend. "Now, Jimmy, what you have to do is..." So when I was about 30 years old, I felt as if I was running the world. So, you know, between all the conversations that we have, I'm sure somewhere along the line, that's where I probably dropped up in the term social artist. Because, you know, what is an artist? An artist is a person who has a kind of passion and focus and commitment and imagination and insight. And what we're trying to do is to help people gain that same kind of artistry, but to apply it to social problems.
That was just a little bit of the interview I did with Jean Houston. I want to thank Jalaja Bonheim for sharing her time with us today. And again, you can visit her online at sacredego.com. And thank you for joining us week after week on the program. Our website is richardbrendon.org. I'm Richard Brendon. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.